Hi, everyone, and thanks for listening to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormorant Strike, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz, and today Lindsay, Sam, Paula, and I will be continuing our discussion of Troubled Blood, and for this episode, we are going to be doing chapters 12 through 14. Thank you so much, Paula and Sam, for joining us today. We really appreciate having you guys on again.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we're very excited about getting into this next batch of chapters. We're getting into some really good stuff here. Let's go ahead and start with chapter 12 then.
You want to read the epigraph?
Sure. The epigraph for this one is, "With flattering words, he sweetly wooed her and offered fair gifts to allure her sight. But she both offers and the offerer despised and all the fawning of the flatterer." This one's a really good one.
Yeah, I like this one.
Yeah. Robin is having none of anybody's BS. It's like, not Morris, not Strike, not anybody. She's like, man, just disappointing, just all around. She's just having a crap birthday.
Yeah, spends it all by herself in the office, just weatherman, boring.
Speaking of flatterers, I love it in the interview with the weatherman, how he's flattered that he has this stalker. And, you know, because after all, he's not a film star or anything. And I love how his wife takes him down a few notches and, you know, when he says, "Who knows what this woman is capable of doing to me?" And his wife says, "If it is a woman, it isn't necessarily a woman." His smile fades away.
It's all deflated. Yeah, that's funny.
Like, aw.
I think my favorite thing about this chapter is the partner's desk. Mm-hmm. I like this better than the setup that they had in the Lethal White show, where she's out in the outer office still.
Yeah.
It's just nice because it's putting her as an equal. They're in the office together, and I really like that.
Yeah, it's a big step forward for them, for sure. Mm-hmm. I remember when I watched the TV adaptation, like the office in that was exactly how I imagined from like reading the books, and that's the first time that's ever like happened to me. Like when you see something that's recorded like that, it's always a little bit different to how you think, but to see it, you know, probably the same was really cool.
Yeah, it's one of those moments where I wish that we could see how they came up with that idea. I like to think it was his idea and she was all excited about it. Mm-hmm.
So with this partner's desk, are they sitting side by side or across from each other?
That's what I want to know.
I'm imagining that they're facing each other. But yeah, I'm not, because they say a couple times that they look at each other, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I think, like a 2x2, so things like stuck together so they're at either end.
Yeah. Something that I really like about this chapter was Robin is sitting and she's understandably pissed at Strike for not remembering her birthday. But even though she's pissed off at him when he's like, "Oh, I have an update on, you know, Bambra, let's get together and let's, you know, talk about it," she's like, "Oh, that's awesome."
Yeah.
She can't help herself. Yeah. She's just so excited about it.
I love that about her. She's so enthusiastic about her job. She just really gets into it. And that's wonderful how it comes out that way. No matter how gloomy she is, an advance in the case is going to, you know, make her celebrate.
Yeah. Strike's the same way too.
I love the way that her mood can shift between being really pissed off at Strike one minute and then like really enthusiastic and up for talking about a case or an idea, and she can just completely shift when it suits. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and I really like in this conversation how Strike brings up about Margot having a personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And why shouldn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, with a cold case like this, it would be so easy just to think of, you know, the victims and those involved in it who are no longer with us to just be these kind of like cardboard cutouts, you know, that they're not real people, but of course they were real people. And it's just interesting, you know, when he has that realization, because they're picturing these old faded photos of these people, of Margot in particular. And she was much more than just a faded photo.
Yeah. She feels so real.
Yeah, that got much more real for Robin. I can't remember if it's this chapter or the next one when she goes like perfume shopping and stuff, and she sees the one that was hers and tries it, and that brings her much closer to that than Strike. But then Robin's always got much closer in terms of that in all the other cases than he has.
Yeah. I liked the gifts that she gets from everybody else in the agency, with the exception of Morris, because Morris is just, God, he's so awful. He pays too little and too much attention.
Yeah, that's a great line. Yeah, no, I liked the gifts from Pat and Barkley too, because it just shows that they paid attention to her. And I think that's what she's looking for more so than any of the gifts from her family or obviously Strike, that mm-hmm. they just listen to her and know what she wants. And that's what means something to her.
And yeah, for American listeners, the gift that Pat gives her, a new purse, is not the purse we're thinking of. It's not a handbag. Yeah. It's a, what wallet. We would call a wallet. Yeah.
Yeah. In the UK, we think of a purse as kind of over the, you know, over the shoulder kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I think of anyway, but I'm a guy. So
yeah. What do you know?
I definitely thought that that's what she meant at first. I was like, oh, she's got a handbag and it's like bright red. And I was thinking about Neville's grandmother from Harry Potter. Yeah. I was like, oh goodness.
As long as she doesn't buy her a hat with a bird on top of it.
Yeah, I think she'll be safe.
No, I kind of got that she meant a wallet when she then Pat says it's easy to find inside your handbag. So I was like, oh, okay. There's a couple of those moments where I have to think, what are they talking about here?
Yeah, usually in context, we can figure it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you guys have like heard mentioned and like read about in the books that is like that? So I mean, something to you guys that might be different for us.
Yeah, we run across stuff like that all the time, actually. I'm trying to find that one word. We'll come across it a little bit later when they're doing their walk through Clerkenwell. What was it? He said he was, instead of giving something a look, he's going to give some, or was that something that...
He was going to have a shufti at it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's like, you know, to give something a quick glance over. So, I might get a report of work because I'll have a shifty at it, and literally you just have a flick through and just get the main points out of it. So kind of just enough to take you through the meeting. Mm-hmm. That's like taking a shifty at something.
Good to know. Yeah, she used that in, I remember Joe used that phrase in particular in Order of the Phoenix, I think it was. At some point they were talking. Yeah. Well, they were at Grimald Place. I think it was like... Sirius was talking, there was something about they needed Mad-Eye to go, you know, look at something upstairs, and it was used in that context. So I knew what that meant whenever I read it, but other folks maybe might not have remembered that.
That's a good memory there, Order of the Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. It's like all the other stuff in the books I was able to like pick out as far as like slang and stuff like that. I could kind of pick out what it meant, but I'm like, what the hell does that mean? and then I figured it out, and then I like saw it here and I was like, oh yeah, I know what that means.
Sam, would you actually use shifty on a regular basis?
Yeah, I probably would. I like picking out like really weird words like that and just using them to death. So I probably would. Yeah.
I think I'm gonna start using it.
Sounds like, oh, these Americans, I gotta explain all these things. All right. So Robin goes to buy perfume, and this is the first that we really see the whole introduction of perfume that became
such a big thing.
So much more important than I ever would have thought.
But yeah, she thinks about why she doesn't like Morris, and like the whole kissing her on the cheek thing is like, oh, dude, there's a right way and there's a wrong way to do this. I just like love that she's thinking, you know, anybody else like Hutchins or Barkley, they would know that you're not supposed to make lips to skin. It's supposed to be the briefest proximity of cheek to cheek. You're not actually supposed to be touching each other.
Morris is just a creep.
He's just a giant creep. And he has a daughter. That's the worst. I feel bad for his daughter.
Do we know he has more than one child, right?
Honestly, I've tried to black out as much information about Morris as possible. I think he does. 3-year-old.
I think he does have more than one kid, but it specifically mentions a daughter.
Yeah, the 3-year-old daughter who has like a ballet recital or something.
But yeah, Sam, you already mentioned her checking out all the perfumes. I really love the whole idea of perfume because I just think it's so much about, especially for Robin, identity and how she sees herself or how she wants people to see her. Mm-hmm. And we really start to see this here where she's analyzing all this perfume and she sees Sarah's perfume and Margot's perfume and what they all mean.
And listeners, Lindsay has done a great job putting together a page on strikefans.com just about the perfumes from Troubled Blood and who wears what and what it might mean, and includes photos of all the different glamorous bottles of each perfume. It's really, if you're interested, please do check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one was fun.
I really love how the whole perfume thing ties into Robin's whole transformation, because, you know, she's has this whole transformation throughout this book of her kind of turning into the growing into the woman that she was always supposed to be. So I think that that's really cool. And I also didn't think, you know, when I first read this, that perfume was going to be that much of a big deal, but it really is. It yeah. really is so significant to, you know, Robin's storyline.
Yeah, she's looking to reinvent herself, and mm-hmm. she's seduced by the fracas. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
She buys. Mm-hmm. It says seduced by the idea of sexy, sophisticated woman who wouldn't be fooled by Matthew.
Mm-hmm. And she wants a perfume that she, you know, thinks that Matthew wouldn't even like.
Yeah.
Fracas is a strange name for a perfume, though. I mean, it means choral or loud, raucous. I guess maybe she wants to upend the tables or something and
mm-hmm. be bold.
Make a yeah. statement. Mm-hmm. But it still seems mm-hmm. a little strange to me for a perfume name.
Mm-hmm. I guess, like, speaking as a guy, I never look at what, you know, what like men's aftershave and stuff is called. I just go by what it looks like what the actual bottle looks like and things. Like, rarely do I smell it and think, oh, you know, that's horrible. Generally, I like most things, and if it looks good, then that's probably the one that I'll go for. But, you know, you guys know a lot better than me, I guess. You know, women take longer looking at that sort of stuff, whereas I'm just like, oh, that'll do, and it's kind of done.
That'll do.
That'll do.
I hear Shrek saying that in my head.
I think of God, what is that? The movie with the pig. Gosh, what? Why am I?
Oh, Babe.
Babe, yes, that'll do, that pig. Movie. That'll do. Oh, that's a good movie.
Yes.
Oh, it was one of my favorites.
I don't think I've seen that.
Oh,
Lindsay.
This happens all the time where I'll say, I've never seen this movie, and then Ken just loses her mind.
Yeah, she's also never seen Anastasia or The Prince of Egypt. What? I don't understand it.
I know. There was another one, too. There was another Disney movie. Oh, Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, how can you call yourself a Disney fan? Yeah, really. And you have, oh my gosh.
I've tried to get Jack to watch it, and he straight up refuses. So whenever he agrees, I'll watch it.
Up until then, though, Hercules it is.
Oh, it's all about Hercules right now. For me, it's been all about Hercules for a long time, but Jack, it's new to him.
Which I'm sure, yeah, now you're just like, oh, you know what? This is perfect.
Is this a good time to talk about my Robin is Meg theory? Have either of you guys seen Hercules, Paula and Sam?
No, that's what I missed.
No? Oh, there's a whole, Meg's whole song in there is like, I won't say I'm in love, don't like get off my case about it. <It's> like,
yeah.
Very Robin. Definitely. Anything else for 12 that stuck out to anybody?
I just loved how Sarah Shadlock's perfume came in a glass hand grenade bottle. I mean, how perfect is
that? How appropriate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talking about how things look, a hand grenade is perfect, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. I'm always surprised, like, you know, this far into the books, how she is still on Robin's mind. Like, even, you know, like this far in, you know, they've touched on those conversations, but the fact that she still thinks, oh, you know, was it her in the text, or oh, was it her, you know, her on the phone when he went out the office?
And that, oh, you mean Charlotte?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course, Sarah. Sorry.
That's a good point, though. She's awfully obsessed with whoever Strike's talking to, but she's not fun. Mm-hmm.
No. And she's not jealous at all.
No. No.
No.
Never. Never.
All right. Should we move on to 13? This is a big chapter.
Mm-hmm. This is very, very case heavy on this one.
All right. Do you want me to read the epigraph, or do you want to?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Let's see. Thenceforward, by that painful way they pass, forth to a hill that was both steep and high, on top whereof a sacred chapel was, and eke a little hermitage thereby.
That's so, obviously, they're just going on the little walk through Clerkenwell, mm-hmm. which I know to say Clerkenwell.
Yeah, some of those English names can be a little like
nothing
yeah,
skip. Is said like it's spelled
yeah well, just mm-hmm. don't mind this whole clump of letters, they mean nothing.
oozed over the pronunciation of Paul Satchwell's name, because I keep wanting to pronounce it as Satchel because of Chisel from Lethal White. So
But so basically in this chapter, they start off at the practice and they walk what would have been what Robin thinks of as Margot's route and what she would have walked to the Three Kings the night that she disappeared. There's a few things that really stand out to me in this chapter. Starting before they actually do that with Strike's reflection on the green dress.
Yeah, and getting that for her. And I particularly love, and I know that you do too, Lindsay, is the fact that whenever he's saying, admitting to himself that when he gave Robin the green dress, that part of it was that he wanted to say, you look gorgeous in this, and I wanted you to know that I thought so when I saw you in it. That he didn't just, Robert Glenister in the audiobook, didn't just use his normal narrator voice, he used his Strike voice for that, and I really liked that. That was a nice touch.
I find it interesting Strike's strategy going forward for gift giving and lowering expectations by either forgetting her birthday.
This is one of those idiot moments.
Mm-hmm. And then of all things, stargazer lilies. I mean, good grief.
Yeah, adding insult to injury.
Yeah, I like the way that dress has kind of been a constant thing all the way through as well. And like you said, Ken's is right from the beginning, I got it because I thought you look great in it and wanted you to know. And that's been the only way he's tried to say, oh, you know, I like you kind of thing at all.
I still say that maybe she'll get married in that dress. I don't know. Throwing it out there.
Now, we need to know whether or not it's actually canon, though, that because in the Lethal White adaptation.
Oh, if it gets fixed?
If it's actually fixed or if it's just still hanging there in her closet, torn and unworn.
I'm sure we'll find out.
She'll have that fixed.
Because I'd like to see her wear it again, though, I don't know. With this new dress that she's wearing towards the end of the book, I don't know if maybe I want her to, stay in the blue one. We'll see, though. But there are some good clues in this chapter, though, that you found, Lindsay, that you pointed out for us. Want to go over those?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so my favorite one, and I just love when they get to Albemarle Way. Strike says, this is the place I can see it happening. And I really love this because he's always so, you know, don't trust your gut instincts.
Yeah.
You know, gut feelings. But his are spot on here. And that's exactly where it happens. And that's where she is. So, oh, we forgot again. We're terrible at this.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So just a heads up, we are going to refer to stuff that happens later in the book. This is a giant spoiler warning. A little late, but
one day we will get ourselves together and remember. We'll have to put it like when we post the show, spoilers.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's happened more than once though before where, you know, in previous mysteries, Strike will make an offhand comment like that, like I can see it happening here or something like that. And it sounds like an offhand comment, but then you go back and read it and it's like, oh, snap. He was onto something even without having the evidence to back it up. His gut feelings are, you know, even though he doesn't trust them, they're spot on.
I wonder if his, you know, mistrust of gut feelings is kind of along the same lines of how he feels about tarot cards and psychics.
Astrology.
Yeah. But speaking of Albemarle Way, you can also go find that page that we did on strikefans.com. That one was a fun one because I thought it was especially important. So,
well, and even the Clarkenwell page in general.
Yeah. Follow along with their walk. Mm-hmm.
And I also want to, and I'm sure you probably mentioned this when you had Sam on before, but he is the webmaster for strikefans.com. We really appreciate all of that he's done for us there because
we need it. Oh my God. There's so much. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know what to do. Call Sam. Yeah. I don't know what to do. Help, please.
Yeah. Who doesn't have hot fixes? So good.
Yeah, I know. For April Fools, I was like, I don't know what to do right now. Message you. Yeah.
And we appreciate your availability. You seem to be able to swoop right in whenever we're having trouble.
Oh, God. No, I feel like I take ages to get back to you some days. I feel really bad.
No, at all.
No.
Just normally wait when you guys message me, like, oh, can you have a look at this? And it's just like, I'm in a 2-hour Zoom call and I'd rather be helping you than listening to marketing budgets. So trust me, you guys are at the top of the list. It's all good.
Yeah. So another clue that I like is when they right behind Albemarle Way is that the first church that they see. And this is where they kind of talk about, you know, you don't expect it to be someone in a church or a doctor. Mm-hmm. And ding, ding.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, Robin says something about how we like attribute goodness to like certain sets of people.
Yeah.
In that particular section. So yeah. Giant clue.
And then my favorite clue here, well, that I think is a clue, is when they talk about passing through the residential homes for the first time. And they say that they're going to look up to see if there's anybody who's lived there for the entire span of those 40 years. And Robin says, you wouldn't dare move, would you? I remember thinking, oh, pay attention if there's somebody who hasn't moved. But then when you come to it, I completely didn't even suspect them because they're not guilty.
Right.
Yeah.
So I loved that one.
Yeah, I like the way, like, later on it touches on, you know, when they're talking about how it could have happened and stuff, and then they say, oh, you know, well, it must have been someone that they knew or trusted, and getting into that mindset was really, really interesting. But again, I can only speak for myself, but it's always the person that you least expect in the end.
Yeah, and the other thing is they talk a lot about how come no one heard her struggling or saw her struggling or heard a scream. And they talk about that a few times, but in hindsight, she was drugged and she couldn't do those things. So it's like, oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the ultimate way to kind of slip under the radar.
Yeah, things you don't notice the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that whole business about not moving in 40 years, you know, makes a lot of sense. Dr. Gupta had even mentioned that, you know, there's such a problem with disposing of a body that, you know, that's why so many people, I guess, thought Creed was guilty this whole time.
Meanwhile, the rest of us that are reading are like, there's literally zero chance. Like, that's great and all, that would be cool, but that he's not the person who did it.
Okay, anything else for chapter 13 for anybody? I know there's a few other things, like the mention of Amanda White's story, or
I guess the only thing I'd say is that I kind of like the way that Strike almost didn't really expect Robin to have read the case notes and the files or anything like that. And actually,
you should take up detection.
Yeah. Just the way she almost came, you know, better prepared than he thought she would do, I thought was really cool.
And I just love, I love this chapter and the next chapter because I love when they're together working a case.
Yeah.
It's always the best.
Yeah. And I think that they enjoy working those too. I think that they enjoy it the most when they're doing it together, which
it's almost like they like each other,
sort of, which reminds me of, we'll talk about it later in the book, but whenever they're splitting up like interviews and stuff, and it's like, you know, Robin's all like, man, he must think I can't do it by myself, and it's like, no, you idiot, he just wants to do the interview with you and spend time with you. I will say, though, that after reading through all of chapter 13, that I also felt like I had earned a pint at the end of that, because that was a lot.
That was a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like, oh, yeah, got to take notes.
Whenever we can actually go to London, this will be on my list of things to do. Walk through and then stop at the Three Kings.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
And take a million pictures on the way there.
Yeah.
Every step of the way.
Partially for yourself, partially for Strike fans.
All right, chapter 14.
Yeah, and the epigraph for this one is another pretty literal one, I think. It's just in which they're written was with ciphers old. I think, Lindsay, you were saying that was about the newspaper clipping, right?
Yeah, I don't see any other
interpretation
there.
Yeah, this one's pretty literal. So it's kind of funny how some of these epigraphs are very literal and then some of them are, you kind of have to think about it a little bit.
I have actually been reading The Faerie Queene, not the original, but a retelling, quote unquote.
It's so hard to follow, isn't it? There's so much
to it.
Well,
the retelling one is pretty easy to follow. So yeah. I thought, I'll read this, and then I got the original on audiobook so that I can maybe understand it better. Because I just, you know, to discuss these epigraphs to kind of have some context and know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Because some of these ones are like cool by themselves, but when you know the context, it makes it even better.
Yeah, well, I'm getting way ahead of myself. But in chapter 71, the way ahead. The epigraph mentions Duessa. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but in reference to Janice, in the Fairy Queen, Duessa is a witch that appears to be nice, but she's really evil. So it's kind of
perfect.
Cool.
It's a nice little Easter egg there.
Okay. So yeah. So they basically go through all these old articles that he found and kind of discuss three of the suspects in the case, which are Roy Phipps, Paul Satchel, and Steve Douthwaite. What'd you guys think of Roy?
I remember being sort of suspicious of Roy the first time, definitely. Yeah. Mainly because in every true crime show I've ever watched, they're always like, it's always the husband.
Well, of course.
Every time.
He usually is.
Yeah. Under normal circumstances, I think that would be a pretty valid suspicion. Like, yep, husband did it.
Or the wife.
Yeah. In any case, the spouse did it. Yeah.
My husband's always like, look through your internet history and you're Googling all your serial killers. Yeah, I think he's a good suspect.
Yeah, I was suspicious of Steve Douthwaite right from the beginning. That the way they set up him, you know, disappearing and everything, that got me suspicious of him right from the word go, for sure.
And then women have a habit of disappearing around him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Paul Satchel, or however you say his name, is pretty darn suspicious as well, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, I can't help but smile when I think of Paul Satchel, though, just because this is one of my favorite. This is one of my top favorite funny moments in the book, where Strike shows her the picture and she's
like, God above.
And just his reaction too.
I thought you might enjoy that.
Speaking of that kind of sexiness, you could call it. When they first go into the pub, the Three Kings, Robin sees a photo of none other than Johnny Rugby in tight leather trousers.
She has I think that happened in a previous book too. Yeah. And it's
in the silk
she has
form.
To like she has to tear her eyes away.
They're at another pub with photos of rock stars all around. And there he is in his tight pants.
But he's also a good suspect because they had a volatile relationship, Paul Satchel and Margot. So his alibi seems pretty good, but all three of these guys are good suspects.
Definitely.
Yeah. Something else interesting that whenever they're talking about Roy and then his relationship with Cynthia and everything was, of course, and like the case just ties in so well with how like the whole character development, relationship development sort of storyline works out in this book. But the whole thing about them being 10 years apart and all of that, and like, oh, it just happens for some reason. We're not sure. For some reason.
Yeah, that it flits across both of their minds that there's 10 years
between them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just one of those things that is like, ooh.
Yeah, I love those little moments that just pop in throughout. Mm-hmm. Not cute or anything.
Yeah. Speaking of, there's another cute moment in here that I think is Lindsay's one of her favorite moments of this chapter.
Is it?
Yeah, there's...
Oh, what are you going to say? I don't know.
Remember Robin calling Strike by his last name for the first time.
Oh, yeah. Paula, what do you think about this?
What I think. I don't get it. I loved it that, you know, she was the only one in his life to call him Cormoran. I thought that was so sweet. Yeah. And now there's supposed to be some intimacy associated with her calling him by a surname. I don't know. I don't get it, but whatever. If it works for people, that's wonderful.
It has grown on me because I started feeling the same way. I really liked that. I thought that all of these other people call him by different names, but she's the one who knows him the best. And so she's the one who uses his real name.
Yeah.
But it has grown on me. And I hope that she won't mind me repeating this, but Clara from the Denmark Street Deep Dive podcast, she said recently in a conversation we had that she thinks that he likes it so much because it's how he thinks of himself. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe more personal. Yeah, and it's not really a nickname because it is his name, but it's kind of that territory.
Yeah, it's like a nickname.
Paula looks, she's so unconvinced. She's like,
she's just like, no, I need more convincing.
Well, maybe it will come in a lot like in later books. Like, you know, maybe. She calls him Strike at work, and then when they're not at work, she calls him Cormoran. And
we'll see. That would be nice.
Yeah. That's what I think is going to happen is, yeah, they're going to kind of have different, call each other different things, or at least Robin's going to call Strike different things at different.
Well, see, I really loved when he called her Ellicott in that Lethal White.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's kind of similar, but.
I don't know. I guess, well, and her calling him Strike, it just makes me feel like she's one of the boys, you know, because that's what all the guys would call him Strike. So. That's another reason I don't see it as very special, but again,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah, don't.
I know that for me, I always notice if someone calls me something different than they normally do. And depending on how I feel about that person will determine if I'm cool with it.
Yeah.
So maybe he, you know, him noticing that and that he does like her so much that he likes it. I don't know.
So that's our daily demand for book six. So I can have more request. Reference material.
Request.
If you say so.
I have a question for Sam from this chapter. And that is, it refers to Douthwaite as wearing a kipper tie. What is a kipper tie? Because I thought a kipper was a fish.
I've never heard of a kipper tie. Okay. Never heard of that. I guess it was
like, I
want
to Google
from...
it.
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna do.
Kipper tie.
Oh,
it's a type of necktie primarily fashionable in Britain in the mid 1960s to late
1970s. Oh, so goodness. It's kind of so. It's
a beast of a tie.
It really is. It's a tie that starts off massive and then gets smaller. Yeah.
Oh, just a really wide tie. I guess it's called a kipper tie because it does look like a fish.
That is, it's like wearing a blanket or a bib.
Like the 70s were horrendous.
Yeah. What were people thinking?
Like someone at the marketing team had to sit down and go, yeah, that's going to be the look of 72. That's what we're going to go for. Wow.
There were so many things wrong. Macrame, I mean, come on.
I don't know. I wasn't alive.
Goodness, those are truly horrendous. Goodness gracious.
I really like the people coming in Halloween costumes for two reasons. One, it's funny that Robin notices that he looks at the girl in the nurse's costume.
Mm-hmm.
Not that she's jealous.
No, although she's like, she's probably more than likely just looking because there are people in costumes. It's still like, right. Oh, she's starting to notice, oh, his interest in other women. So that's kind of like, ooh.
But also just in rereading, this is another nice clue, just pointing, it's a nurse's costume.
Mm-hmm. That too. It works on so many different levels. I love that about this book.
Oh yeah.
It's so good.
So what do you guys think of the Pittman shorthand? I didn't know what that was.
I had never heard of that until I read that in this book.
I didn't know there were different kinds of shorthand. T-line is what Robin learned apparently, but not Pittman.
Yeah, in the UK we have like prescriptions, and you know, you go to the doctor, they write down like antibiotics or whatever. You basically get like a slip of paper. It's digitized as well, but you can get that. Then you take it to the pharmacist, and then they give you what you need. And literally, it's like a squiggle, like some weird line. And like, you know, normal people don't have a clue what that means, but other doctors and stuff can look at it and go, oh yeah, and that's it. It's just it's really common here. I'm amazed that, you know, you guys don't have anything like that.
Maybe that's what it is, and we don't know what it's referencing. I mean, we always joke about doctors writing handwriting being,
maybe that's why they're writing in shorthand.
Exactly. How's anybody supposed to read this?
One thing I really like that comes out in this scene as well that has come out previously is Robin defending Pat. And, yes, you know, she says, you want to go back to temps, fine, but I like getting accurate messages and knowing the filings up to date. You know, she's constantly defending Pat's competency, you know, against Strike's criticisms, which I really like. Because I like Pat too. I think
I love her.
I hope she sticks around.
Yeah. I think she will. Yeah. I think that...
Yeah, go on, Lindsay, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that Pat and Strike are actually going to really grow to like each other.
Definitely.
Yeah, same here. I think from what, you know, from everything, I thought they were just really similar, but neither of them wanted to admit how similar they were. That's why I think they're going to get on really well as time goes
on. I can
on.
See that, because they're both kind of rough on the outside, but a couple softies on the inside. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I could see her being like a second in command best mate that he doesn't have sexual tension with, that he can just be like chummy with. I really like the idea of them being just like you were saying, rough on the inside, catch a couple softies, you mm-hmm. know. I love their relationship so much, and I love that it's so antagonistic right now, and Robin's just like no yeah. She's great, you're being stupid.
Which of course Robin is right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. She has a yeah, she knows.
Always. So the actual translate, I mean, we talked about Pittman shorthand, but not what the translation was. It says, "And that is the last of them, the 12th, and the circle will be closed upon finding the 10th unknown word, Baphomet, transcribed in the true book."
Hat coming through.
Well, and it was interesting here that, you know, Strike was familiar with that reference because of Jeff Whitaker, you yeah. know, and that's another creep from the past who I bet we'll see again. In a future mm-hmm. book.
Oh, definitely. Oh yeah, me too. I don't think that he's, you know, the one who killed Leda, but I hope that something happens to him that's bad.
So do we think that the solving of Leda's murder will be the final book in the series?
I've kind of always thought yeah. that. Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
But I don't like to think about final book. No.
Yeah. Yeah. If she wants to keep on writing them and writing them and writing them and writing them, I think that she probably could come to a head with the whole Leda thing and then just keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that Lindsay and Ken's have asked you, but Paula, who do you think killed her?
You're asking me?
Yeah. Who do you think?
Well, what is the name of the lawyer that worked for
Peter Gillespie.
Peter Gillespie. Thank you. Peter Gillespie, I don't know. He seemed awfully protective of Rokeby in an unhealthy mm-hmm. way, you yeah. know, going after Strike like mm-hmm. he did. And I could see him going after Leda, and especially what we know now after Troubled Blood and how Leda handled the finances and how all that, you know, antagonism was going on. I could see Peter Gillespie just being a freak and...
Yeah. No, there's two lines from chapter 58 that made me think that as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think I know exactly the two that you're thinking about, but we'll come to that.
Yeah, yeah.
is that when Al is talking to Strike?
I think Strike is retelling Robin, but
okay.
But yeah, there's a couple things in there that made me think of him in that way. So
yeah.
I don't want to get too, I know I've already jumped to 71, but try to rein it in.
Yeah. Did we have any more thoughts on this episode or on this set chapter. Of chapter? Yeah, this chapter.
I did like, one of my favorite quotes in the book is in this chapter, the observation that Robin makes about the name of the pub. And it says here, Robin was struck by the odd idea of a reverse nativity. The three magi had journeyed toward a birth. Margot had set out for the three kings, and Robin feared met death along the way.
Yeah, I like that one too. Oh, God, this book is so full of so many good phrases like that. It's
almost like it's a really good writer.
who could have guessed? Who could have guessed? All right. Well, I guess that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard so far, don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod with regular updates announcing future episodes. If you'd like to send us a response to anything you've heard or have something you'd like us to discuss, you can always email us at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another exciting episode of The Strike and Ellicott Files.